Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and we are on facebook.com/radiocafe. Day two of the Santa Fe Film Festival that can be found at santafefilmfestival.com, and we are spending the entire week talking to filmmakers from the festival. I'm very happy now to welcome Adam Ross. He is writer, producer, and director of the film Cash Crop. It's a documentary screening as part of the Santa Fe Film Festival. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Welcome. Welcome to you, too. We look forward to being out there. Thank you.
We look forward to having you. Now, this is a documentary about the marijuana-growing industry in California, and that's big business. I mean, the film is called Cash Crop for a reason. It's big business, it's healing, it's a way of life, and you cover it all in your film. How'd you decide to make it?
You know, I've been filming for 2 years, really undercover, off the radar. Didn't even tell my mother what I was doing until a few months ago. And I started out wanting to do a small, short film because I knew some growers in Southern California who were going to give me access. With a partner, we formed a film company later, and he proposed going for the full feature-length film. And he was from Northern California, so he had some hookups, I had some hookups, and I developed a false film title, kind of an alias to work under when we'd get stopped and whatever, called Homage, and we were working under the film title of Homage as we had access all over the state. The idea of the film was California is, you know, the sixth or seventh largest economy in the world, equal to France, and this is the number one cash crop in the United States, number one in 12 states, one of the top three in 30. Nobody has a clue what's going on, kind of where the milk comes from. So the film was devised really as a non-advocacy piece, but access, showing access to a way of life. And we had access, unique access throughout the state, and then later with everyone from sheriff departments to DAs, once we went a little more public, when we knew we wouldn't be followed any longer. So it's basically a film from Tijuana to, kind of Eureka, I have found it, up to the heart of the Emerald Triangle, where most of this comes from.
There's a lot of footage of the growing of marijuana. Now, in some cases, that's legal because it's medical marijuana. In other cases, it's not. How did you get people to agree to be on camera?
You know, it's a little bit of a brave new world every time I went up there, and I have to point out that I was simultaneously filming on the East Coast back and forth inside an inner-city school. So, as they say down here, it was pretty gnarly, the whole episode. But a lot of people are advocates. They feel very strongly about what they're doing. It's supporting as much as 90% of the economy in these areas, and they're proud of it. They're proud of their, for example, Mendocino is the first county in the United States to ban GMOs. It's the heart of the organic movement, the back-to-the-land movement that Alan Chadwick led coming up from Santa Cruz. So there's a real movement there in organic growing. And they're very proud. There are naturally a lot of other people who would not appear on camera or were masked. And there are generations, new generations of growers. And it's multi-layered in terms of it's really a people story. It's really about the people.
Well, one of the people who I found fascinating was the sheriff of Mendocino County, who is a very likable fellow who really thinks that marijuana should be legalized because he doesn't want to see law enforcement wasting its time on something that really has no negative consequences compared to especially other drugs like alcohol and meth.
Yes, Tom Allman is a real right out of Central Casting. We became good friends. I even brought him for his first time to New York City to see an inner-city school in the hood where I was filming, and we became fast friends. And incidentally, he's become an additional hero in that he is healing with the burns to his hands after rescuing someone, a dying woman, from a burning vehicle. So he's a real character and a real hero in a way, and a voice of reason in the film. He is actually a Republican, and he's kind of libertarian in his views. Even the debate, to give you an idea what got me into this, when I got up to this area, they were holding the debates for district attorney and sheriff at the Mendocino medical marijuana advisory board facilities. So I felt like I was in an early American Quaker meeting hall, and the real democratic approach and the debate and the involvement of the people was really stirring and really interesting. And in a way, in this subject, I kind of found the heart of a lot of core American issues in an unlikely place.
And those core American issues are ones we've been dealing with really since our founding and before. For example, really living off of the land and dealing with greed and dealing with sustainability and things like that.
You know, it's interesting. As I filmed, this is really a true documentary in the sense of I'd scout and shoot. I had to go out there undercover and with people who could hang. I'd have to road test my crew. Sometimes a skeletal crew. We shot everything high def, so we pulled no stops there to get the best footage and best sound we could. But as I shot it, I didn't have a script. We really went on a mission to see what was there and then develop the story from what we saw and document that, as opposed to what most kind of quasi-documentaries do now, where they have an idea, a thesis, they go out, they follow the script and put in a bunch of background footage. With this, we really scouted and shot. And initially, when we started, it was a little terrifying because it was during the Bush regime, and there's a lot going on with DEA and arrests and whatnot, and that's why we had the fake film title. And one of the issues at that time the film was framed in was states' rights. Interestingly enough, an issue that hadn't been brought up since segregation. And here we had California with its Proposition 215 medical cannabis law declaring states' rights. So this was an issue that first framed the film. However, later it kind of changed as we saw the issues of sustainability in their economies, where logging and fishing were gone. And now we have three, as many as four generations of pot growers in some of these areas supporting 90% of the economy. So even people on the far right support it. Where it really became integrated into see how it worked. Then you had the medical issue. What is medicine, really? Is it something a drug company tells you or advertises, or is it something people plant-based that have been taken for thousands of years? You know, you have propaganda, you have the old Hearst stories with the hemp issues, when the U.S. used to be a hemp-based economy and the synthetic fibers coming in, hooking up with the pharmaceutical companies. And I tried to keep it non-doctrinaire and not have a advocacy on either way, but I would see these court issues unfolding. Then it became, I remember Obama's first interview, he used the word sustainability 10 times, and I thought, my goodness, this is really what it's about. And shortly thereafter, we had our economic crisis, and it really became framed later again, the whole cash crop idea was, wait a minute, you have Bernie Madoff and AIG and subprime mortgage lending and Wall Street. Is this a more ethical form of entrepreneurial capitalism than what these organic marijuana growers are doing? So it was all upside down. And my job, in a way, was to frame these questions of, you know, self-government, freedom, entrepreneurship, greed, and sustainability. And that's really very much the heart and soul of the film.
We're talking to Adam Ross about the film Cash Crop, which is screening as part of the Santa Fe Film Festival. And by the way, it is screening Friday at 9 o'clock at the DeVargas Cinema. One of the things that you don't really go into in great length, but that is the subtext of the film, is a lot of doctors must be prescribing marijuana, whereas they might have prescribed other drugs earlier in time. Because the medical marijuana industry is huge, and a lot of it is legitimate patient use, if not all of it.
It is, you know. I mean, and very. That's why it's so interesting, and it kind of, I don't know if it's a microcosm or macrocosm, because it is our biggest cash crop in the country. But it really posing this question is, what is medicine? And as I mentioned, you know, formerly things were plant-based. And it wasn't until the, you know, Marijuana Stamp Act of 1937, really a relatively short time in history, that this plant become illegal. And most people throughout the world, even, you know, aspirin would now be by prescription only, that was really from native, derived from birch bark. So a lot of plant-based medicines became replaced as a pharmaceutical company is kind of hooked up with Hearst and the timber industry to outlaw hemp and any plant-based pharmaceuticals. And I know I'm sounding a little like the normal website. I'm really not trying to push an advocacy at all, but it's all common sense stuff in regards to medicine and doctors. There's an industry there, too. There's doctors who see 16 patients an hour and just write recommendations left and right. And they're doing pretty well with that. So it brings everything to the forefront, health insurance, what is medicine. And it really puts the responsibility, you know, locally on people in states such as New Mexico now to decide what do people want to do rather than it kind of being prescribed from above. How do people work out their own medicine, what medicine is, how they want to be treated, and what they value. And what was particularly of interest with this, this is a plant with a long history and a lot of use. So it really tied things together in terms of what is medicine, how do we treat ourselves, how do we find ourselves in this web of our environment, and what can we sustain?
One of the interesting things was this sheriff of Mendocino County had a good friend who used marijuana after he had a very severe injury, and that really turned him around in terms of realizing that there are productive citizens who use this as medicine to deal with their pain and to deal with other symptoms. And I think this movie serves to do what that experience did for that sheriff, which is just introduce people to facts that they probably had not known before.
Right. You know, for me, I was very set on not becoming a kind of a website for factoids and information. My goal is and was and has been to humanize the story, as, for example, you resonate with the sheriff, or someone else might resonate with a patient, or someone might resonate with a young grower. It's a people story. It's a human story, and these are human decisions that can't be just based on numbers or statistics. A lot of the issues we might be talking about have to deal with abuse, and the sheriff addresses that as well. So it's not so much the cannabis or marijuana, as it's called. It's the abuse or dosage and how things are used and how we want to live our lives.
One of the things that was interesting that you go into was the relationship between growers and other ranchers, vintners, and crop growers in the areas where this marijuana growing is taking place. And they kind of pretty much get along with each other, is what it looks like in your documentary.
Yes, they do. You know, there is, and interestingly enough, we will be having a benefit screening in Northern California, because one of the things, for example, that the sheriffs and the growers unite on is the anti-meth campaign. And it's almost an interesting demographic in certain counties like Lake County and to a certain extent previously in Mendocino County. Literally, the marijuana growers would come in and kind of push out less desirable meth labs. So there's a lot of aspects of where ranchers and farmers and even loggers are stewards of the land. The timber mill prominently featured in the film, he was the center of the timber wars in the 80s. There were bombs placed under cars and all that, and there's so much backstory to every one of these stories. The loggers and the growers and the protesters became friends as they're mutually supportive. So it really became who are stewards of the land, who is developing something that's responsible and sustainable. And very much the heart of organic movement, organic farming, but also a real kind of very quintessentially American approach to these values of entrepreneurship and responsibility and sustainability. I was blown away by that aspect to this culture. And it is really a cultural film more than anything else.
One of the things that you go into a little bit is the fact of police raids, the fact that the feds are really interested in cracking down on marijuana growers and users, and and that drug busts really finance law enforcement. They clean out your bank account, and then the money is theirs.
Absolutely. You know, Tom Alden, the sheriff of Mendocino, was incidentally a cousin of the Alden brothers, was proud to tell me about the wood chippers and helicopters and all the great new toys the police department was getting by seizing assets. And that's going on now in with Cooley, who is the district attorney down in Los Angeles, and it's going on throughout the state. One of the growers we feature, for example, raided for being one plant supposedly over the limit, had everything tied up, and now the Mendocino District Attorney wants to reduce it to a public nuisance after 2 years of prosecution and obviously a lot of legal costs. So in a certain way, there's a lot of harassment, and a lot of the harassment is from lack of understanding and fear. And what I'm trying to do with this in part is my conviction is with knowledge and awareness, people move away from a fear-based society to one of true interaction and understanding and mutual support that we're all in this together.
It is astounding, given the state of California, that it's a bigger cash crop than any other fruit or vegetable that we eat and live on.
It's actually bigger than soybeans, grapes, and all that combined. So in 2006, the LA Times estimated, I think, a $35 billion a year business. I believe it's a multiple of that. The indoor growing, which is a whole other aspect, has gone crazy, and the different ways of growing. So all these estimates are based on a percentage of eradication efforts. There's much more than meets the eye that's going on with this.
One of the things that I found interesting was one of the users of medical marijuana was saying that it's not that it takes away your pain, but it distances you from your pain so that you can handle your pain better. And so I was thinking about that, and then I was watching one of these other people in the film who was a grower who was very sanguine and sort of happy and then saying, yeah, my jury trial starts tomorrow. I'm charged with several felonies. I thought, my goodness, this man is distanced from his own, what probably anybody else would experience as massive fear.
Yeah, well, you know, for example, that those people who I actually met through the Marleys, there is a whole subculture of Rastafarian growers who only provide for the Rastafarian community, and that's over $100 million a year business. And this going up there, literally with my crew, you enter a parallel universe, another world where people are living, they're walking the walk, they're living according to their values. It is what's sustaining them. And returning to regular urban or other American life, it would be like I was on the moon. It was just another life. So the ludicrousness of some of the things that they have to deal with, there's so much politics involved. Even now with President Obama's supposedly pulling back, there's a kind of, it seems like, this is just conjecture, but there's a little bit of a good cop, bad cop approach where the feds are pulling back but kind of letting the locals loose. And in some cases, you have to realize you have towns where you have people who went to high school together, but one person's making a multiple of the police officer's salary growing pot. And there's a certain amount of resentment. There are agreements. There is money flowing in all different directions. And each county, that's one of the things I tried to bring out, is different. It's almost like a different state from Sonoma to Mendo to Humboldt, where certain ones are more purely money-based. One of the things you'll see in the film is Humboldt has its own currency. So it's very diverse, and that's really part of the aspect that's quintessentially American about all of this.
The film is called Cash Crop, and it screens as part of the Santa Fe Film Festival on Friday at 9 o'clock at the DeVargas Cinema. Adam Ross is the writer, producer, and director, and you have made a special edit. It's almost the premiere of the film. I think it has shown in one festival prior to Santa Fe. Is that correct?
It is. We, you know, as I mentioned, I've been undercover for a couple of years. My mom didn't even know what I was doing, and finally we went public in June, and it seemed like an appropriate festival. We're invited to premiere at the Maui International Film Festival, which is known as a conscious film festival blessed by the Dalai Lama. We thought, okay, this sounds good, and we won. And we kept going, and now we realized there are things we wanted to improve. There were new footage we wanted to put in. We wanted to tighten it up. I also am a musician by trade, and I did all the music to the film. So there are a lot of things we wanted to tighten up and improve upon. And Santa Fe is really our premiere of something that now we really fully stand behind as a film we really love.
Well, it's a terrific documentary, and I want to thank you for being here on the Radio Cafe, and we'll see you at the DeVargas.
We are so excited. We're all coming in Friday, and we're just really looking forward to being up there.
Excellent. I'm delighted now to welcome Stephanie Argee and Alec Baim. They are co-writers and directors of the film The Red Machine, which is screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival, along with their short Gandhi at the Bat. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So this is a terrific movie, The Red Machine. It's a heist movie set in 1935 with sort of the snappy, quick-talking characters, and a very, very amiable and likable safecracker.
Oh, thank you so much. That's Donald Tom Scapello, who is actually going to be with us here in Santa Fe at both of our screenings, along with his parents. But he is terrific. We met him when we did Gandhi at the Bat. He's also in that one as the A's first baseman, Jimmy Fox. And he was very obliging about letting us hit him in the head with a baseball. And we recast him again in Red Machine.
He's a great actor, and it's an interesting story. I mean, he's a safecracker who never gets caught. Somehow he gets caught, and he's recruited by the Navy to steal a machine, and as we will hear in this clip, steal it without really stealing it.
Exactly.
Is this based on any kind of actual code machine that you researched or that you knew about?
Yeah, we did a lot of research on this one. There really was a Red Machine. It was Japan's first machine for encoding secret messages. And there were other machines that followed on it. And everybody knows how those codes and those machines were cracked by the military.
Other Japanese machines.
Other Japanese machines and German. Everybody had their own code machines. It was a great race. But the Red Machine, how it was actually cracked and how the U.S. Navy decoded the codes is shrouded in mystery. Nobody really knows, but there are rumors of break-ins and other events, and we ran with that. What a great story.
So it's not really a true story, but there's some truth woven in.
Right, and it's a conjecture of what might have happened, but of course a love story has to be woven in.
Well, yeah.
Very much so, yeah. And that Eddie, the thief, is called Eddie, and his minder for this mission is a very stiff, cold Navy spy. And over the course of the movie, we discover that he's actually the subject of our love story. He broke a heart and had his own heart broken in Japan years before, and the re-encounters.
And there's little flashbacks to that.
Right.
And what's great about it is it's very well crafted, the film. So the flashbacks are very recognizable because of the color and the sensation of them. And the strangeness of that character, of that Navy spy. How did you develop that character? He's so cold, he's almost robot-like.
Well, he's broken. I mean, he was on a mission in Tokyo 7 years earlier. And even though the mission went well, things, you know, with his girlfriend at the time didn't go well.
He felt as though he had really, really hurt and betrayed some people, and the character made the decision to shut himself down. And our thought with the character was that he's essentially has killed himself in a certain way without the formality of actually dying. And that's how we find him. And that's why we wanted to have that extreme performance. And Lee Perkins, who plays him, was very brave about going to that extent, because that's not easy to ask an actor to do.
Yeah, it's surprisingly difficult to do so little. I mean, because it's not like it's not like you're doing so little, but to appear to do so little. And it was, you know, it was really interesting to do it. And you know, he would keep wondering, well, you know, should I do some of this? And you keep kind of saying, well, now let's see less. Mm-hmm. And
especially when there's a heartbroken lover inside.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And then. But when you put it all together, it becomes this extraordinary thing, and it is a strange performance, or it is a strange characterization. I would agree with you there. But I think it's extraordinary.
Did you look to movies of, say, the 30s and 40s for style?
Very much. We've always really liked that era of movie making. So things like for the dialogue, His Girl Friday, or Bringing Up Baby, were big influences on us. The Maltese Falcon was a big one. And we also looked at some of the 1970s movies that were set in the 1930s. So things like The Sting or Hard Times, and those were an influence as far as the aesthetic as well. And then the third element of the mix, we also looked at some of the old French capers of the 1950s and early 60s, which were very bold in their use of silence. And that was an interesting example as well.
When you look at movies that are made in one period, which is now long gone, and set in another period even further gone, they sort of betray their aesthetic, like The Sting betrays a 70s aesthetic, mm-hmm. even though it's set far earlier.
Yeah, you can totally tell yes. when it was made.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's funny.
And I think when you do this, you have to know, even though it's hard to see your own time, that you're doing that as well.
Very much, yeah. There are certain aspects of it, I think, the choice of the technology that we used to make it, how it was put together, just the language that we all speak right now, the filmic language, is a particular dialect that in 10 or 20 years will be totally different.
But we also didn't want to just make something. We sort of consciously set out not to make it look like, well, let's make it look like a 30s movie.
No.
Because we could have tried to do, oh, let's make it black and white, or let's, you know, choose a filming style that's very slavish to that, and we thought, no, that's not appropriate.
That's actually what we did with Gandhi at the Bat. The short that plays with this is a mock newsreel. And for that one, we researched and did about 17 hours worth of tests before we shot to make that one exactly like a 1930s newsreel.
And we were very strict on that one. Here's how it has to be. It's a very, a newsreel, a very narrow path that it takes.
Yeah, we can use these lenses. We can move the camera like this. We can, very, very particular. And we did consider it for Red Machine, but we wanted it to have its own style that was a gesture to the period, but its own modern interpretation.
Yeah, and then it's fun, and you can use color in a creative way, and so on.
Right. Which we did as well. I don't know if it was noticeable when you watched it.
You did mention it a bit about the colorful flashbacks.
Yeah, which you did. Well, for the flashbacks, we completely obliterated the color red from the modern part of the movie. We said red is only in the past.
Right.
Until the very last scene of the movie, when our two characters are reunited, she's wearing a red sash.
Ah.
But also, we wanted the world of the thief and the world of the spy to be very different. So everything in the thief world is shades of brown, and everything in the spy world is blue or gray or black. So that's very, very cold and mechanical, whereas the spy's or the thief's world is very organic and full of life, as he is.
And because, the two characters, the thief goes into the spy world and it's totally foreign to him. And the spy goes into the thief's world a little bit and it's totally foreign to him. So they both stand out like sore thumbs, and that was on purpose.
And they don't get along very well at first, either.
They don't get along very well at first.
No, not at all. No, it's a classic buddy movie dynamic there.
Right.
But they're forced to work together and say, okay, what are we going to do?
Now, when you work with color like that, it's funny because I suppose other filmmakers and film aficionados notice that, but for everybody else, it just goes in unconsciously, but it still has the effect.
Mm-hmm.
That's
I
the hope.
So.
Yeah, that's what you do with so much of what you do with filmmaking. You don't want it to be overt, but you want it to enter in on that subconscious level.
Yeah, you really don't want people to notice what you've done. You just want to feel it, I think.
Right, and to be seamless.
Yeah.
Now, you Alec, are a musician, and you also did the music for both films.
Yeah, kind of inadvertently. We were looking for a composer, and we met with several, and weren't quite finding what we wanted. And when we were putting the film together, we didn't use any temporary score. Because normally when you edit a film, you put in temp music to kind of suggest what you want the music to sound like. And we were afraid if we did that, we'd fall in love with something that sounded like that and then find a composer and say, okay, make it sound like that. And that's really not very fair.
Right.
So we always, we'd talk to composers and not have anything in it. And they were, I think, getting a little frustrated with, not having any reference. So we talked to one guy, and he said, well, can you put in... Actually, you know the story better than I do.
He asked, you know, just lay in some sketches, lay in something that would show me what it would be like.
Some sketches, yeah.
Some sketches, or even just any kind of music. So I said to Alec, well, why don't you just put in a few things that you've done? And he did, and suddenly we heard it and said, oh, that's the music that we've been looking for all along.
So I hadn't planned to do the music, yeah. But I'm really not a film composer. But it sort of fit. And then I would, and then I took it seriously. I sat down, okay, I'm going to do this music for this scene. So I do this music for this scene. I give it to Stephanie, and she'd say, oh, this would be good in this scene. It was never the same scene I'd done the music for.
Oh, isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. So you make a film like this. The two of you do everything. How do you, I mean, it's the classic question of independent filmmakers. How do you manage it? How do you do it?
Creatively or financially?
Both. Well, financially.
Financially, we also work for other people in varying capacities. Alec is also a cinematographer of these projects, and I do editing, visual effects, and write as well. So we scrape together the entire budget. We had saved up money and got to this point.
And for post-production, we owned all the gear
to that
already, which we know we had that for a while and learned how to use it.
Yeah. But when it came time to make this movie, we had a certain amount of money saved up, and we said, well, we could do a big down payment on a house, or we could make a movie. And given what happened to the real estate market, we're glad we made a movie.
Yeah, really. We're talking to Alec Bame and Stephanie Argy about the film The Red Machine. Tell us a little bit about the short Gandhi at the Bat.
Gandhi at the Bat is a mock newsreel about the little-known incident when Mahatma Gandhi pinch-hit for the New York Yankees.
Little-known because you made it up.
Well, exactly. Well, we didn't actually make it up. It's based on a short story that originally appeared in The New Yorker in 1983 by a writer named Chet Williamson.
A marvelous story.
Yeah, it's just a great little story. And we found it, and Chet was kind enough to let us adapt this. And it was thrilling. It's been... Red Machine is just starting on its film festival life. We debuted at Mill Valley, and then this is our second festival ever with Red Machine. Gandhi at the Bat came before that, so it's played all over the world. It's played in Germany, it's played in India, England, France, Italy, everywhere. It's been the most amazing learning experience to have this little movie travel and touch people in so many ways. And that was what really introduced us to Santa Fe, because Karen Redhawk Dallet got a copy of Gandhi at the Bat, and she contacted us about that one, and we said, well, we have a feature too, and she booked them both together, which is the first for us.
Oh,
yeah,
we're
opening for ourselves. Which I'm curious to see how that goes.
Yeah.
Now, are you looking for a theatrical release, or what do you hope the life of the Red Machine might be?
We're exploring. Right now, there are so many different options in terms of independent film distribution. So we are looking for theatrical exhibition, but in a smaller way. We're not really looking for... We wouldn't rule it out, but we're not looking as hard for a traditional distribution deal. We're very interested in exploring what they're now calling hybrid distribution, where you split apart your rights, and one company might handle a limited theatrical release, one will handle DVD sales, one will do foreign things. And that's what we're looking into right now. So it gets a little more complex, but...
And it seems like it's changing, which is, you know, I think it's pretty exciting to be... In the cusp of that, to have a movie at this point when things are changing. It's like, okay, well, let's see. And since we paid for it ourselves, we don't really have to do anything except explore.
We can be very bold and very experimental.
Right.
So they're not people, you know, screaming for their investment back.
Exactly.
So we can be pretty experimental. So I think it might be a rare opportunity that we get, so we might as well explore it as far as we can. So we're going to experiment.
It's an interesting moment in film right now. We were talking about this with Karen and with John Bowman, the executive director of the film festival, that filmmakers can now afford cameras and editing equipment and everything else and make their own films. And you own your own cameras, mm-hmm. and your own editing equipment.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the sound as well, and you know, the post sound and
right. And so what would have been impossible 20 or more years ago is now in your apartment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's thrilling to have the freedom to do that. I think, I don't know if you read the book Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. Uh-huh. It's a really cool book, and he talks about how achieving mastery at something, to become really, really skilled at something, is a matter of time. Spending, say, 10,000 hours 10, doing a particular
hours.
Thing. That's the number.
That's the magic
hours.
Number, yeah.
It is. And in the past...
And we should have kept better track.
We should have. But... You think back to the old studio days, and filmmakers and actors and everyone were able to get so much more experience. There were so many movies being done. And now we're almost coming back to that again, where you can work so much, you can do so much on your own. And as a filmmaker, you can learn and practice and grow
Because it's like anything else, you need to practice. You need to spend time doing it.
Right.
And if you're waiting for the studio to say yes or no, you're just waiting.
And it's interesting because, I mean, in my position interviewing so many filmmakers, I've seen some wonderful films like The Other Bank was one of my favorites of this festival, and then some that really were just not that good. And I was talking to the man who made The Other Bank after our interview, and I said, what do you do when you have these people who've made a movie that just isn't very good? And he says, tell them never give up. So people who are making these movies that, you know, their first try is, you know, somewhere between dismal and mediocre, they might still end up making a terrific movie 5 or 10 years from now.
Think about your first try at almost anything. It's probably not going to be very good. Your first pancake or your first attempt at playing a song on a guitar.
But the stakes are so much higher in a movie.
It's true. Well, it goes back to what you said as well about the new technologies, that it does make the entry a little bit easier and make more room for that kind of experimentation and practice.
Well, Stephanie Argee and Alex Baim are co-writers and directors of the film The Red Machine and also the film Gandhi at the Bat, which are both, they're playing together, and they are on Friday at 7:30 at the New Mexico History Museum and then Saturday at 6:45 at the DeVargas Cinema. And it's great to have you here for the Santa Fe Film Festival.
Thank you. We are thrilled to be here.
Thanks.
Can't wait to go explore Santa Fe.
Excellent. And here's a little clip from the film, The Red Machine.
See, people generally let you know where to keep the most valuable thing in their house. Throw it in its clothes when the rest are open, an extra neat table underneath a painting. You might as well just put up a sign that says, hey, burglar, look here. For instance, in Shimada's apartment, you look down that hall and every one of those locks are standard issue, except one. That's a schlag. Schlag is a fancy, expensive lock, kind of generally see on the outside of a building, very secure. So first off, you figure, why have a lock like that on the inside of the apartment? I just see only one. Another thing, the floor in front of that door is full of scuff marks. Just a lot of foot traffic going in and out of there. Only question is, how do we get it out of there?
We gotta figure out how big it is, how much it weighs, is it fragile?
You think we're supposed to take it out?
In my experience, that's the best way you steal something.
Not this time.
No.
They suspect anyone anywhere has even seen the machine, they'll instantly stop using it and switch over to a completely different system.
And we don't want that.
No. We want them to go right on using this one for as long as possible.
So we gotta steal this thing without really stealing it?
I'm delighted now to welcome Rod McCall. He is the director, writer, and co-producer of the film Becoming Eduardo, which screens as part of the Santa Fe Film Festival. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is a terrific narrative film about New Mexico, filmed with at least some New Mexico actors about what's going on in this state, high school students and the challenges that they face. How did you come to make this movie?
Well, the story is based on a novella by Lou Ann Johnson, who wrote the book that the film Dangerous Minds was based on. And she's an educator herself, so she understands the process, and she's lived in New Mexico. I fell in love with the book. We got together, and I got the book rights, and we made a movie of it last summer and been working on the cutting and everything since then. So it's been quite an experience. It really shows a side of New Mexico that people don't normally see, the rural communities, where they face a lot of the problems that the more urban communities throughout the country face in terms of youth problems.
And those are the classic problems that stem from poverty, drugs, and loss of culture as well.
All of it. All of the above. Yes, indeed. Yep.
There's also the continuing problem of dealing with the system that labels children not as potential citizens but as future felons. That was one of the words that really stuck out for me in the film.
Yes, and that's one of the odds that Eddie Corzon is the main character has to deal with. He's a 16-year-old kid who grows up in a rural community and is lucky enough to have several people in his life that act as inspiration. and then not lucky enough to have several friends of his that are encouraging him to deal drugs and stuff. So he's kind of on the fence. And he finds his voice, and he finds himself, and he finds a new life in poetry, strangely enough, believe it or not. So,
and that's it's an interesting thing, because there is quite a lot of fantastic poetry that appears in poetry slams that is made precisely by communities, Black communities, Hispanic community poets, that expresses what they're going through and comes out being really the art and rhythms of our generation.
Indeed, and a lot of that comes out of music, a lot of rap and things like that. And this kid in the movie and the story that is built around him is all sort of touched by that, inspired by that. And you see it through that lens.
Another character who is really notable is the teacher who at first Eddie, the main character, thinks is going to be some kind of organic tofu-eating lady. And she turns out to be quite a tough and supportive character.
Yeah, she's a very cool teacher, and she inspires him to a large degree. First of all, she gets him into this ballroom dancing class, basically because he needs the credit. He's taking it not so seriously when he enters it, but then he meets the love of his life, Lupe, who is his age, a beauty, college-bound beauty, who sort of pushes him to do his best. And so he has something in both his teacher and his girlfriend, and then ultimately his uncle, who he's sent to live with because he gets in trouble and he has to leave the community for a couple of months. They send him off to another school. His uncle, who's a forest ranger, also is a big influence on his life and sort of helps him turn his life around, begrudgingly. There's a lot of funny scenes between the two.
Right, and it's quite a charming movie, even as it does build tension all through the film, because you really don't know if he's going to be okay or if something terrible is going to happen and
right,
and
which
how
way he's
going
to go, yeah.
Right, and that's another thing that I think is really interesting, and it's interesting in the movie and in life in general, is that a lot of social change is reflected in how people relate to each other in their love relationships that develop in high school. So the way Eddie's mother and father related to each other and the choices that they made, and then in the next generation, Eddie and Lupe, the choices that they make are quite different, and you see what the potential is that might come from that in how they, if they do stay together, which of course you won't know, how they live their lives in the future.
Well, I think it's part of the learning process for Eddie. He watches his parents. He observes them like all kids do. His parents are both well-meaning, wonderful people. Unfortunately, they're poor. Not terribly educated, but they have a kind of wisdom that's rather sweet and helps them with their culture and also with their coming life, giving them pieces of advice that sort of stick and sort of reappear in different parts of the film, so that Eddie learns that that's not necessarily the way to go, and he finds his own way through Lupe, through his teacher, and through his uncle, and then ultimately through himself.
You have some actors who are newcomers and some who are real veterans,
yes.
Like Elizabeth Peña. How did you put the cast together?
Well, we had a casting director, a lady who's cast three of my films. Two of them have been at the Sundance Film Festival some time ago. And her name is Kathy Henderson Martin. She's a kind of iconic indie filmmaker, casting director out in L.A. One of her big fames to claim is that she discovered Farrah Fawcett Major. And she put her in the original Charlie's Angels. So she's been doing this for a very long time. I adore Kathy, and she got me hooked up with Liz Pena and A. Martinez and Julian Alcaraz, the young actor who plays Eddie, who I think is going to be a big star. This kid just got a lead role in the remake of Red Dawn, which is a big studio film.
Oh,
they're
wow.
Shooting in Michigan. Yeah, if you saw the movie, I mean, he's quite charming in the part. And a beautiful kid, and a really hardworking actor, very imaginative and very smart. He's only, when he shot the movie, he was only 18, and which is hard to believe because, I mean, he knew his lines coming on the set. You know, we made this film in a very short time, and the reason why it works is because we had wonderful actors, most of them from Los Angeles, most of them all SAG actors, But we had some local talent. We got a couple of kids from the arts high school down here in Las Cruces, Alma de Arte, and the head of the school, a lady named Irene Oliver Lewis, who plays the ballroom dance teacher, if you recall, the sort of funny, heavyset lady. She's right. Hilarious. She's hilarious in the film. And then Eddie's friend and Lupe's friend are both kids from that school. So we balanced it out very nicely. We got a lot of New Mexico talent, obviously, in front of and in back of the camera. And, you know, that's what's happening in New Mexico. We're developing our own film culture here. And as a sideline to that, I should tell you that this is the very first feature film to come out of the new film school down at NMSU called the Creative Media Institute, where I teach and was one of the founders. And we're very proud of that. After the screening on Friday, we're having a big reception. Unfortunately, it's invitation only, but we're having a reception to celebrate that. People from the university and people from CMI and a lot of some politicians and stuff are going to show up, and we're going to celebrate the fact that we've sort of, in a way, put ourselves on the map, because I think we've produced this sweet little film, hopefully it's going to move an audience. So,
when you say New Mexico has developed its own film culture, say more about that.
Well, I think that we have a lot of terrific crew members. You know, with the film incentives that came in the last 10 years or so, there's a lot of production going on here. And the thing is that in the beginning we were concerned that Hollywood was going to come in, use our money, shoot their movie, and leave. But a lot of people have stayed behind in the industry, both actors and crew members, both sides of the camera. And we've started to create our own films out of, you know, our own culture here. And Becoming Eduardo is a good example of just that. And we're very proud of that.
And it's always nice to see Latino film actors being able to do expressive lead roles. Let's not forget Elizabeth Blanco, who plays Lupe.
Oh, she's wonderful. She's a gorgeous kid and wonderful actress. Very sweet. Again, extremely professional. You know, these two, their scenes together, there's a lot of magnetism between the two kids.
Yeah.
And they're sweet to watch, and they became friends during the production. And, you know, they would help each other through it. I mean, a good actor is often at his best when he's listening to the other actor, because he's egging the other actor on. He's helping the other actor with his part or her part. So, and they both were terrific listeners to each other and to the other actors in the film. So, you know, and the older generation, Elizabeth Pena and A. Martinez and Gary Perez and Josh Cruz, all of the older actors, mom and uncle and so on and so forth, who played those parts, all helped the younger actors, and vice versa. So, you know, they all give each other energy, and that's part of a situation like this where everybody gets on board basically because of the script. You know, these days there's a lot of big Hollywood films done that don't even have scripts. It's basically explosions and car
right.
chases and whatever. And this is a character-driven part that an actor can sink their teeth into, and that's why they did the parts, you know.
Where was it shot?
It was shot down in Hillsboro, New Mexico, and in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. Those two places. Hillsboro has an old community center that once was a high school, so it was a natural set. And most of the sets and most of the shooting that you see there, except for a couple of the road shots, were shot within like a 3 or 4 block area. It doesn't look like it in the movie, but that's how we did it. So.
Well, Rod McCall is director, writer, and co-producer of the film Becoming Eduardo, which is playing as part of the Santa Fe Film Festival at 6:45 on Friday, and then again at Saturday at 2:30 in the afternoon at the DeVargas Cinema. Rod, thanks so much for being with us, and we look forward to your future work.
Thank you, Mary Shaw. I really appreciate it.
And once again, all this week, we are talking to filmmakers from the Santa Fe Film Festival. The Santa Fe Film Festival can be found on the web at santafefilmfestival.com. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website, santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find me at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month, George Shearing.